Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Boy, and let's meet our first contestant this week, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind Danway.com, a native of Johannesburg, South Africa. His hobbies include picking fights, causing trouble, and hurting the feelings of the Chinese people. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Good evening, Kaiser. It's a pleasure to be here in Beijing with you.
Let's also say hi to Ada Shen, who is sitting in for David Moser this week. Hi, Ada.
How you guys doing?
Ada, as podcast listeners, loyal ones anyway, will recall, joined us for that Charlie Hebdo podcast back in January. Many of you may remember Jeremy's infamous rant from that one and little else. We really enjoyed having her, and so much that we have thought we should convince her to come back in and host every now and again. Ada does various work in media and in the nonprofit sector, so a do-gooder, and I should say very, 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 very old and dear friend of ours. Now, Jeremy, you met her before I did, or did I get her first?
I think I must have met her before you. I met her the day she got off the plane,
I think. Yes,
I think so. Okay, right off the plane?
Yeah, we worked together at the legendary Beijing scene.
Just so, you know, so. That's right. I think I hit on you the first time I met you. Is that right?
I have no recollection.
Okay, thank you.
You are a lady, Ada. He is not a gentleman, but you are a lady.
But there are a lot of people in this town, as it turns out, who think that we are related.
That's funny.
Yeah,
that's
because
really funny.
Apparently we have the same precise accent, like the same Northern California ABC accent or Southern California. So you're from Southern California.
Yes.
I'm from Arizona, which is a cultural appendage of Southern California.
So that's why.
I sound like you're right. Anyway, we're both sort of robust.
Loud.
Right. Okay. Anyway, so Ada, welcome.
Thank you.
Several times now on this program, this show's various hosts and guests have made really enthusiastic recommendations for the blog Chublik Opinion at chublikopinion.com. Today, we are delighted to be joined by Mr. Ma Tianjie, the author of that blog, which if you are not already reading it, you really need to just go and read right now. Ma Tianjie is formerly with Greenpeace, recently went to China Dialogue, whose founder, of course, is Isabel Hilton, has been a guest on this program. Jeremy, how many times now? Like three times or
two or three times.
Anyway, tell us a bit about yourself, Ma Tianjie. I mean, you're a great mystery to many people out there, but I think, as it turns out, there's a ton of fans of your blog. I mean, I promote you kind of crazily. First thing I think that people notice is how good your English writing is. Did you study in the States?
Yes, I did spend 2 years in Washington, D.C., getting my master's degree in environmental policy. But I was an English major in college at Peking University here in Beijing. But I consider myself largely a product of the Chinese education system, which I happen to be born and raised in Shanghai, which has pretty decent English education.
Right.
I think that helps a lot. And then I was an English major. So I think that helps again. I also
modest.
Like to read in English.
And he's fabulously talented as a writer.
Yes,
it's just
he
natural.
Is. I mean, I think that it's what's odd is that I think most people would assume that you're a native English speaker on reading your writing. I mean, it's quite idiomatic. In fact, it's often beyond the abilities of most Native American English. I mean, if you go to your average Tumblr, you're not going to. Well, we don't do that. Well, compared to YouTube comments, he's really not.
Yes, exactly.
Anyway, so how would you characterize the mission of your blog? What do you do?
Well, at the beginning, it was very simple. I just want to practice my written English because I think a part of me wants to write more elegantly in English. But at that time, I was working at Greenpeace as an international organization. I have to write a lot of emails, internal documents, proposals, and things like that. And it feels a bit boring to me. And also, it's very stressful work, working in the environmental field in China. So I just write to relax my brain and engage a slightly different part of my brain and spend a whole, like a good 10 hours on a Sunday just to write a piece that I feel is coherent. Mm. And I really enjoy doing that. And that's all.
And why did you choose, public opinion is Chinese public opinion, right?
Yeah.
Public opinion with Chinese characteristics.
Why did you choose this particular field, this niche, this subject matter?
Well, at that time, actually, I was quite inspired by a Chinese column written by a guy called Xu Danei, who used to be he was an editor at Dongfang Zaobao, a Shanghai newspaper. And he wrote for the FT Chinese for 6 years, a column called Meiti Zhaji, which basically, I think, I basically stole the concept from him, right? He aggregates all the different sides of opinion from Chinese newspapers and opinion leaders on particular issues. And he writes in a very, like, dispassionate way, right? He didn't take sides, but he just noted them down with kind of hidden thread in it. And reading him actually gives you quite a good grasp of what's going on, what are these sort of currents inside the Chinese.
Well, you've just described very, very well what you do.
I got the whole idea initially. I think I got the whole idea from him.
Okay, that's the last bit of false modesty that we're going to get. No, seriously, it's great. But there was a lacuna. There was a big gaping hole in the English reading world.
Exactly.
Right. Did you realize that, hey, why isn't anyone? Because, I mean, Danway used to do this, but then Danway stopped doing it.
Then we became capitalists.
And who else was doing it? I mean, so you have...
You had Roland Sung doing it, also ESWN.
Right. You know. But not... Yeah, okay.
I mean, he was more
maybe
compiling stuff.
Right, compiling
but, I mean,
stuff.
There haven't been a lot of blogs analysis. That have dispassionately and without trying to take sides looked at what is going on in Chinese media and social media in this way.
Identifying also really important discourse that's happening. I mean, the stuff it's not the China smack kind of this is, you know, the salacious story of the day or whatever. You actually went for the stuff that matters.
I think they're doing this. You could do it in a very mechanical kind of way. So I can act like a machine and I just grab, like using sort of an algorithm to grab whatever you can. But I think in the process, I find that if I put in a little bit more agency and kind of my analytical lens into it, I could get some observation out of it. And I'm not really ambitious to depict any kind of grand picture. But if you keep it as a habit and just note down whatever observation that you think you can logically get from some of the things that you actually see, and you accumulate it, and maybe in the long run, you will find some really interesting stuff. One thing that I noticed, I think, from last year's blogging is this subculture thing, which before that, I really never took a serious notice, right? It's only after I saw this guy, the Ho Jusen, this kid, gotten beaten up by his political rivals, right, on the Baidu Tieba, it became a national sort of a spectacle. And I just realized, oh, there's this whole group of kids hidden in Tieba that they're worshipping the national state as if they're worshipping a K-pop star, right?
Tieba, we're talking about
Baidu Post Bar.
Baidu Post Bar.
Post Bar, yeah.
So can you describe the subculture a little bit? Explain...
The D-Bar culture.
The D-Bar culture. What is it?
So a Tieba essentially is a business, sort of a business model for Baidu, if I understood correctly, right? So it's organized around keywords that people actually search.
Right.
On Baidu, which is a search engine, essentially. And then in order to facilitate the kind of discussion and community building on the internet, so whoever searched the same keyword as you are
winds
able to
up in the
find
same conversation.
You, right?
Exactly.
And then so people start to self organized into different tier bars. And I think it's a very perfect place for subcultures to flourish, because people with the same interests, people with the same hobbies will group together.
It's like being able to create subreddits in Reddit, right? It's probably the closest analogy, right?
Yeah, I think Reddit is probably the closest thing you can find in the English world. But I think what's interesting about Diba, this particular Tieba, is that it transformed from a sort of a hobbyist group to some kind of a much broader thing, because it's sort of organized around the discursive strategy, right? Mm-hmm. It originally, it's just about a stupid soccer player, right? But then people find that the way people talk about the soccer player is more interesting than the soccer player himself, right? It's getting meta, right? So more people are attracted to it because they like how people, the unique ways people talk about stuff, basically bad-mouthing others using a kind of smart-ass kind of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so it, I think, snowballed into something completely different. And in the end, it has nothing to do with the soccer player anymore, but physically it's still located in that post-bar.
They become a community, like a little tribe that has completely lost any kind of affiliation. It's sort of like, you know, in ancient Rome and in Byzantium, they had these favorite chariot tiers, these chariot teams, the blue team or the green team, and they became these political factions, right?
Exactly, yeah.
I think you mentioned in your blog post on that some of the terminology coming out of Diba is now part of more mainstream internet terminology, like diao si, gaofu shuai.
Did that originate there in Diba?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's fascinating, because diao si is every, I mean, everyone. I was in a conference with a VC friend of mine who said, the only thing you need to do to win China is figure out how to sell, you know, what do the diao si want.
Can we explain diao si for listeners who may not?
Dick shreds.
So it's kind of loser, like you don't have any money, you've got a shitty job, or
no prospects, no future, no girlfriend.
Yeah. Is that?
It's a very complicated evolution of a word. So first, diba, because it got very popular, it also got its own rivals, right? So people, there are a group of people who don't like the diba people, and they have their own tieba, and they start to refer to these diba fans as di si, right? So si is the fans, right? The
fans.
So di si, but di si doesn't make any sense. So they add make it diao. Diao means dick or penis, right? So so it's an insult, actually, of the diba people.
Mm-hmm.
But the diba people like took it as a pride, right? And use it.
Right. They reclaimed it.
Yeah, reclaim it and use it by themselves to refer to themselves as diao si. It seems that they embrace some kind their lower social class with a pride. And then they start to invent all the references to the opposite social class, like the gao fu shuai, the bai fu mei. And they take this very...
These are the tall, beautiful,
rich
people.
Yeah. And they use very like self-depreciating postures, like gui qiu, I beg you to something. Like
I beg you on bended knee, right?
Yes. And it's really a play on their own social class, and it's sort of deconstruct all the hostilities. I think the anthropologists might need to study the real cultural implications. But
and in that particular post, though, you looked at what they did when they decided to do something politically. They took a political action, and you know, there's of course the irony of the fact that to do something that they believed was patriotic, they had to first climb over China's infamous Great Firewall to do it. And can you tell that story a little bit to people who haven't read that? I mean, what happened with the attack on Facebook websites, Facebook fan pages of pro-independence politicians and celebrities in Taiwan?
Sure. I think before this year's election, the general election in Taiwan, I think there has been a lot of going on in mainland China, right? There is this guy called Huang An, which is a third-rate singer who has this one song which was popular in the 90s. And he sort of waged a one-man campaign against so-called pro-independence Taiwanese pop stars in mainland, sort of tattling them to the Chinese authorities, saying, oh, these are pro-independence, you should ban them in mainland China performances, things like that. So the mainland Chinese public at that point has been alerted of the so-called pro-independence people, and there's quite some debates and discussions about that. And then came Zhou Ziyu, the 16-year-old pop star from Taiwan, who is actually doing her business is mainly based in South Korea, right?
Right.
But she is trying to develop her career in mainland China, and became the target of Huang An. So then again, there's a whole dispute over this Zhou Ciyu, and in the end, she was forced to apologize.
Forced, like, by her agent or her managers?
Yeah, because there's Chinese online...
backlash against her.
Yeah. Backlash against her, and she has to apologize in front of the camera. And,
as so many people have had to recently.
And then what actually... abject apology, though, and she's 16.
It was very sad.
It was very sad.
It was very sad, yeah.
But what actually triggered the Diba attack was that the Taiwanese trolls, basically, on Facebook start to attack a Chinese mainland pop star, a TV star, right, who said some joking things about Zhou Ciyu's video, right? So this is, I think, part of the competitive, the Diba crowd or the subculture is quite competitive in its nature, that if they see that, okay, my people is being bullied, then I want to just fight back. And
do you think the politics actually had very little to do with it, or do you think that it?
I think it's the need to establish one's superiority in terms of power. Like, it's very much, I think, like school politics, right?
High school.
If one of my gang get bullied by the other side, I want to just hit back. And there was some a review of past campaigns by Diba. And usually it's something like that. I want to overwhelm your Tieba just to punish you for whatever shit you said about things that I don't like.
It's a bit like an anonymous attack.
4chan is the other group they remind me of. 4chan is the other community that in America. You know, there's a million, well, all of the stories that you've written about we could talk about for an hour each. But one question I've been really dying to ask you is, so how much harder, first of all, is it to glean a sense for what's happening online in China now, with Weibo use having kind of plummeted, with Weixin being sort of more private in nature and confined? What are the online forums that you would go to get a sense for what the spirit of the times really is?
I think it's still pretty intuitive. So I do follow quite some people on Weibo. I think Weibo, even though it's subdued somewhat, I think still relevant. Especially, I think, those who has the intention to shape public opinion still are pretty much active on Weibo, even though I think a large part of the liberal camp has been subdued on Weibo. And some of them did migrate onto WeChat. So I think my methodology is that I just look. If there's something that there's a real conversation going on, there are different sides of voices on a single issue, and I think it's hard for me to miss. And I would wait a little bit to see what kind of comments and what kind of insights finally would emerge on my, like, whether it's Weibo or my WeChat walls. And I made some selection, and based on that. Yeah.
Great.
Just for a sense of perspective, Kaiser, would you like to drop in sort of the random internet factoid on the size of the audiences of these respective platforms, even if Weibo isn't
still I haven't followed in a while. I don't actually know.
It's, Jeremy, it's, do
it's
you
really
know?
Hard. I mean, Weixin.
I don't know the most current figures, but I mean, you know, Weixin must be, you know, north of. I mean,
have you ever met a Chinese person with a smartphone who doesn't use Weixin?
No, I mean, in fact, I mean, WeChat Weixin is probably has higher numbers than like main internet usage, because everybody's got a smartphone and so they might not actually use any other internet service. So I mean, you're looking north of 700 million probably. I think within Weibo, at its height, Weibo was about 500 million or so. And I mean, I would imagine the active usage is probably a fair bit lower than that right now.
Okay, right. Just a little context.
I think you're right, though. I mean, that there still are public intellectuals who to be found. I actually had lunch today with a reporter, an American reporter, who said that after kind of a long hiatus from Weibo, he went back and was really quite surprised to see, because, you know, everyone is back. You're sort of looking for the reaction about Ren Zhiqiang. He said... So Ren Zhiqiang is, you know, some people are saying the Donald Trump of China. So he's
a ridiculous comparison. He's a billionaire real estate developer.
He's not a billionaire.
He's a millionaire. A multimillionaire real estate developer who used to have 37 million followers.
Right. So he's kind of a buddy of Pan Shiyi, and he was a very, you know, he's a party member and but was always a very prickly kind of writer, right? He was always kind of critical, always sort of a thorn in the side. He was something of a gadfly. And as we know, he made up basically a couple of comments to the effect of, after Xi Jinping's kind of recent media tour, in which, you know, he basically insisted on the steadfast obedience of media, of state media to the party. He said, wait, what's this about the government being the party's government? Isn't it the people's government? Isn't this the media the people's media, not the party's media? And so that kind of distinction between people and party was, of course, anathema, because people are represented by the party in Xiist ideology, or in, you know, in all communist ideology. So anyway, so my friend was saying at lunch today that, you know, he thought that after the Big Beep crackdown that, you know, began in earnest in 2013 and kind of gutted Weibo by 2014, that Weibo would be a wasteland. He said no, that most of the Gungzhi, the public intellectuals that he followed, were still quite active. They were on there. He was very surprised, still as critical as ever.
Yeah, because I think there is still, I think, a need for agenda setting. And as long as there is a need for agenda setting from all kinds of camps within the Chinese society, then I think Weibo is a much better platform than WeChat, which is essentially a social network that based on friends, right? But Weibo is a much, much bigger platform, a much open platform with a sort of a square kind of
public
effect.
Square, right?
Yeah, exactly. Public square, yeah.
One of the questions that I wanted to ask you, do you know if you have much of a Chinese readership?
I do have a small Chinese readership. I if I look at the WordPress data, then I can see a segment of readers from mainland China, even though it's much smaller compared to the readership from the United States.
And what about comments from Chinese readers?
The thing about blogging today is that a lot of the conversations are happening in social networks that I have no way of knowing. For example, people would repost my post on their Facebook page, and then they will probably have conversations there. But
I
have no way of of seeing what people are talking about. And yeah, that's a pity.
Okay. Well, hopefully this show is going to get you some more readers, and they'll be very, very well deserved.
Yeah. Thank you. I hope so.
Can I ask you to answer a question you posed in your own blog? You wrote a post, January, A Moment of Reflection.
That's such a good one.
And you say, after a year of blogging about Chinese public opinion, I realized that the biggest challenge, besides the limitations of available information and the constantly evolving situation, is to assess its actual impact. Just how consequential is the collective airing of certain sentiments or viewpoints? Do you want to take a stab at answering that question?
I'm going to duck out. Thanks, Jeremy, for making our guest feel.
Well, I think the question really, I think it's a pretty philosophical question about what is public opinion, right? So everybody in China holds some kind of opinion, but a lot of those opinion doesn't matter if they doesn't surface in some kind of form with some kind of impact, right, on whatever platform. So I think gauging that kind of impact become a kind of defining point for whether there is actually valid public opinion in China. Because I think in the past, there is always this thinking that there is no public opinion. I think especially if you look at the years before the emergence of social media, then all you have is probably something reflected by the media, right? The sort of the liberal, slightly liberalized media scene. But I think with the emergence of social media, you have a much more materialized kind of public opinion, which might have some actual impact, especially in the politics of this country. But I sort of like the observation from Song Zhibiao, an observer, a Chinese, a former commentator from Southern Metropolitan News. He says, I think there is a very strong discrepancy between how the state views public opinion and how the public views their opinions by themselves, right? So if you look at the distance that the state wants to go to crush whatever threat they see from public opinion, It's actually really ridiculous. The recent case of Xinhua News Agency spending all the investigative sort of capacity to debunk that fake dinner in Jiangxi province. Mm.
Right.
Phoenix Man story.
They actually spent that much public resources just to debunk that nonsense, right? And also...
And that nonsense, let's just describe the nonsense. So that was, the story was that a young woman from Shanghai went to her boyfriend's house in Jiangxi, rural Jiangxi.
And got scared
family. And ran out back to be horrified at seeing this sort of really badly cooked food served in really unattractive
metal
bowls and stuff. And then it was a fake story, as you note.
Yeah. Yeah, and but it took the China's the most prestigious news agency to basically wrote a story and debunk that myth, telling everybody this is a fake story. It seems that they take the direction of the conversation really seriously.
They're hypersensitive to public opinion that doesn't go away.
So, but if you ask someone in the public, they would think that this discussion is like, doesn't matter. Okay, so somebody just got scared off by a bad dinner, right? And I had some random opinion to air. What difference could that make? But on the other side, they take it like dead serious and would take no chance of letting it free flow into something they couldn't control.
I'm imagining President Obama holding a meeting, about this series of YouTube comments. I mean, it's right. It's impossible.
Your answer really then is that we don't know, or you are not sure how consequential the collective airing of certain sentiments or viewpoints is. But the party thinks that it's very, very serious and consequential.
And shall we... Then if the party thinks so, shall we then take it as face value, which means it actually touches the nerve of the party, right? So because of that, shall we take public opinion in China more seriously?
So there's like a discursive reality.
That would be my conclusion. Or rather than just sort of discounting it because it's really these sort of casually, flippantly thrown out things. I mean, there's not a lot of thought being invested into, my expression of this online. There's no cost. I don't have skin in this game, right?
Mm.
I can see it either way.
There was a lovely turn of phrase that you used, and you use many, but there was one that really struck me as being kind of thematically resonant with your overall blog. And that is, you were talking about how, opinions comes to sort of settle around equilibrium as opposed to consensus. And in this respect, you were talking more about, I think, the government's reaction around the Caijing environmental video.
Under the Dome.
Under the Dome, which, if you'd like to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, because this is your wheelhouse. You work in an environment, presumably you've looked a lot at about civil society as it's been kind of congealing around this issue of so please,
yeah. Yeah, I think the interesting thing about this field in China is that unlike in the Western society, particularly I think in the United States, where the environmental issues now is also part of the cultural war, right? So the right, the conservative side would deny everything, or they would basically attack the entire environmental agenda as a liberal kind of issue. But I think this kind of cultural war really doesn't exist in China. At this moment, there's my reading at the time when I watch Caijing's Under the Dome is that there is a consensus,
universal acclaim, right?
Yeah, a universal acclaim of that documentary, and there seems to be a consensus that the environmental issue is something that we commonly need to address. But I think the backlash later on was sort of unexpected to some extent, because I think there was some confusion even by people who have been closely watching this field. Initially, there was strong endorsements. There seems to be strong endorsement from the official
MEP,
side. MEP, the new minister, and also Renming Wang, the People's Daily's website, all carried this documentary. But then the backlash, the final censoring of it, and I think recently, I think the conservative left was still like attacking it as some kind of plot to undermine Chinese development really makes me rethink whether the consensus was as strong as I thought it was. That's why I think the current status about air pollution, for example, how the central government is dealing with air pollution is really the result of an equilibrium. So there's the public is pushing people like Chai Jing, people like other, including Ren Zhiqiang, they were pushing to extend that the government couldn't ignore pollution anymore. And they have to supply a certain level of environmental actions, right?
Right.
But on the other hand, I think the public also has lost a large part of its leverage to push further to more radical, drastic kind of environmental actions. And they have to accept the current schedule, which is basically cleaning up Beijing sky probably in 20 years, 30 years, something like that. And to accelerate that, they have to overcome the kind of resistance from the other side.
And this is an issue in which public opinion has to an extent been welcomed. It hasn't been shut down as forcefully.
It hasn't been shut
down well.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. Because I think in certain areas, the government does need the backing or the cover of public opinion to push forward some of its initiatives, especially if you want to push Hebei to shut down a large part of its industrial base, then you probably need some backing from the public opinion, pointing out the discontent citizens from Beijing, saying that I couldn't have this public accusing me all the time, right? I have to do something. So I think they do need some allies in the civil society to push forward some of the agenda items, especially the green agenda items. But
so
on the other hand,
tie this back to the Diaosi. I mean, they in international politics, they often have to do the same thing. They want to use the sort of force of public opinion to back them on things like Nansha Qundao and the Nanhai issue, on the Diaoyu Senkaku issue, right? Sort of whip it up whenever they want to mobilize it instrumentally, right?
But I think that's slightly different because I'm not sure how seriously the Chinese public is really concerned with those islands.
I think the organic reality
and the authenticity of concern you're right. For example, air is, I think it's just much more potent.
It's unavoidable.
Yeah, I think
it's also one where the public and the leaders have exactly the same problems. I mean, if you live in Beijing, no matter whether you're in Zhongnanhai or in some shitty apartment outside the Sixth Ring Road, you breathe the same air. Right.
Exactly.
Well, let's turn to, I'd like to ask about another subject, another post you wrote about called Das Evil Kapital, which I found quite interesting, where you look at a fight going on with one of the most successful real estate companies, the Wanker Group, or Wanker. I mean, in English, it's V-A-N-K-E, but in Chinese, it's Wanker, which is, in pinyin is kind of like Wanker. But Wang Shi is the founder, a very charismatic guy, climbs mountains. And again, let me just put a little quote there. I mean, you're talking about how this guy who has been a hero and still is in many ways in the Chinese media. And you write, no matter who emerges in the end as the winner of this bid for the control of China's largest home developer, and this is Wang He, the loser is already visible. It's the idea of philosopher king capitalists as the progressive force to change China.
That was the
Wang He. Drama has revealed the fragility of the public image that Wang Shi and an entire class of so-called progressive Chinese capitalists have built for themselves. Mm. Can you talk a little bit about this? Because, I mean, this is very interesting. And I think in some ways in real estate industries where you've seen it the most, where you have these charismatic and very popular figures, Ren Zhiqiang is another one, and Pan Shiyi and his wife Zhang Xin.
Tech too.
I mean, he's absolutely
not a national, but absolutely
technology. I mean, your boss Robin Lee, Alibaba's Jack Ma.
My boss isn't tweeting. He isn't on Weibo and stuff. But
they are seen as people who are philosopher king capitalists, right?
I think in China, at least in the past few years, I think there are groups of business tycoons, basically, but they are seen as more enlightened.
Yeah.
People like Wang Shi, people like Pan Shiyi, they are also quite aligned with the sort of the liberal kind of values and agenda, and they're pushing forward. Like Pan Shiyi is also someone who actually make air pollution top on the national agenda, right? As a kind of an environmentalist kind of messaging in his communications. So I think there,
as you said, billionaires breathe the same air.
So there are, I think, some expectations from part of the Chinese society that they could be the sort of the change agent that China needs, because they also have the material, right? They have the money.
And they have the standing.
Yeah, and the standing and the sort of the moral leadership they could provide to lead the country to a slightly different direction. But I think what I am personally surprised is looking at the response to this Vank takeover is the kind of hostility towards Wang Shi himself and the kind of doubts people have really in his comments about his adversary and really how thin actually his political capital really is, especially with the public. And it's I think for me, it's a quite stark contrast of the public image that I had about Wang Shi. Because among his peers, actually, Wang Shi is the one probably with the best public image so far. And for that public image to be tested in such a way and be challenged and be sneered in such a way, I think it, for me at least, is a pretty unexpected turnout.
Yeah. And don't you think, though, that some of it isn't just kind of schadenfreude of somebody who's, you know, extremely successful in a society where most people are, you know, if not struggling, at least it's not that easy. I mean, I have to confess even myself to a certain feeling of schadenfreude about Ren Zhiqiang, because I'm like, well, you know, you've been like this big and kind of arrogant voice on the public scene, you know, saying things like, you know, poor people kind of deserve to be poor because they were too stupid to buy real estate, you know, 15 years ago when it was cheap, which I feel myself that I was kind of too stupid to buy real estate 15 years ago when it was cheap. But I mean, isn't that a very natural reaction to...
You were also too poor.
But I was also too
poor. Yeah, the downfall of somebody successful, doesn't that always cheer the common people to a certain extent? You're like, ah, actually, he's just like us.
Yeah, I think there is definitely an element to that. And I think that the Diaosi culture kind of play it into it a little bit, because I think the prominence of the Diaosi culture actually makes those who act like they're nobler, they're like holier than thou kind of personalities more vulnerable. People tend to see them as more like pretentious. Mm. So I think nowadays many celebrities on social network, on different platforms, also try to drag themselves down a little bit closer to the Diaosi to make themselves more relatable to them.
I
right?
mean, the recent popularity of the phrase "jie di qi."
Jie di qi, yes. So
I mean,
I think
everyone wants to be jie di qi, and it's like.
And I think Wang Shi is probably a person that doesn't really adapt to that. And he still act quite aloof in his speeches. He doesn't make like Jie Di Qi jokes with his fans and things like that.
So this is a generational shift then?
Maybe. I think the younger generation is more accustomed to a more Diaosi kind of self-deconstructed kind of culture. And they expect that the public figures... be relatable to that kind of culture. If they don't, then there's a backlash against them. Yeah.
What are some of the other stories that you've been playing with that we might expect to see in coming months? Some of the other interesting subject areas that you've been looking at that you might be itching to write on?
I don't plan that long. I really, it's an intuitive thing.
Are you taking requests, though?
The good thing about keeping a personal blog is I don't have a deadline to meet. So if I see something interesting and there are enough conversation that I could get a grasp on and I could have something to play with and cook with, then I would write something about that. If not, even if it's a very important story, maybe to the media or something, then probably I wouldn't, because I...
Yeah, and see, that seems to be a deliberate, an approach that you use, which I think is interesting, is because almost none of the stories that you write on are things that the mainstream English media has actually caught wind of and made into a story. So do you deliberately select stories that you think the US media has, or the English language media has kind of missed?
No. No, don't do I don't do that. like the parade was pretty big.
Yeah, I think but your take on the parade, I mean, who was writing about it from the perspective of the historical nihilism debate? Well, nobody else was.
Yeah, maybe. I
not
think
not in English.
Maybe that's in sort of a reflection of the different nature of conversation that's going on within China.
So yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. What is a frustrating thing to a lot of us here is we talk about these issues and I feel like we're having these conversations that are in parallel to and never quite intersecting with similar but quite different conversations that are happening among our Chinese friends and colleagues and family members, right?
Yeah.
And so what you're doing is it's a different kind of bridging. I mean, you're actually saying, okay, so this conversation that you're having over here is it seems to have very little to do with the conversation on what is ostensibly the same topic that's actually happening among ordinary Chinese people. That's, I think, a very valuable service.
Thank you. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think one of the purposes of Seneca, right, is to try and help fill in some of these gaps.
Yeah, but we don't do – I mean, I think the one thing that we can do is just have you on the show more often. Really, no, seriously. I mean, you don't know how hard it is to find really, really kind of articulate English-speaking guests who are really watching the news in China. Because if their English is that good, generally you're working at a fucking investment bank or doing something like that. You don't want to come on a podcast and talk about
or a tech company,
right? Or a tech company. Anyway, but I'm very grateful and I hope that you'll be joining us more often in the future.
I'll be happy to. I live just one block away.
So. Oh, awesome! Party in your house. Ada, let's you know, as you're the newcomer to the show, let's start off with recommendations from you.
Okay, so I have a recommendation that has nothing to do with China, but in a way, maybe a little elliptically, can reference some of the gaps also, that even in the United States, we have gaps between what the pundits observe about phenomenon happening within a subculture and how maybe that subculture observes itself. So my reference is a video. It was a selfie video that was posted by Charles M. Blow, who is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. And he's talking about the way that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are perceived in the South based on their civil rights activities and the difference between working on segregation issues in the North versus working on the question of white academies, which were basically it was an end run around desegregation laws where literally they created these white private academies. So and they took out all the white kids, all the white teachers, and all the materials, including the books. And this is what was happening. And it was all supported with state money at the time. And Hillary Clinton actually went in and helped to expose this, and that this kind of thing helps to explain the voting patterns of African Americans in the South, more so than some of the external observations that have been placed on it by other pundits. So that's my recommendation. You can find it from his Facebook page.
Charles Blow.
Charles M. Blow, and it will have posted March 1st. It was today.
Okay. Awesome. Should we go to you, Jeremy?
Yeah. We're shortly going to experience the 50th anniversary of the start of the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. And I'd just like to recommend the film Morning Sun. And And it's not that easy to actually watch the film, but there's morningsun.org is a website that is really excellent, has a lot of bits from the film, audiovisual materials, all about the Cultural Revolution. This film was made by Kwame Hinton and Jeremy Barme, and it's actually kind of like a prequel to the film they did about 1989, Tiananmen.
Right.
And explores
the Gate of Heavenly Peace.
The Gate of Heavenly Peace, which it explores actually in many ways the same kind of themes, and they are two films that one should watch together, ideally. But if you don't have access to the film, morningsun.org.
It's a great recommendation.
I have a film recommendation too, but I wanna let Matienzia go first.
Okay, I have a very light recommendation. It's a comic book. I don't know if you have read it. It's a comic book by a Canadian from Quebec, I think. It's a book called Shenzhen, a traveler from China. It's a hilarious book. This guy was sent by a French company to supervise an animation they are making that they outsourced to a Shenzhen workshop, and it happened in 1997, right before the Hong Kong reversion to China. Uh-huh. So he spent like a year in Shenzhen, and he's like a comic book writer. So he draws a comic book about his experience in Shenzhen in 1997.
Is it in English or in French?
It's in English.
Oh, great.
So it's just hilarious.
Can you get it on Kindle, do you know, or is it?
I don't know. I got it in Belgium.
Okay. this one may be hard to get, but let's
see. Okay. But I think you can find it. It's published in English.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
This guy also did.
It's called Shenzhen, a travelogue from China.
Okay.
This guy also did one book on North Korea.
I've read the North Korean one. It's really, really funny. Yes. Yeah, and excellent. Not so funny in some ways, but really excellent. Yeah. He did the same thing in Pyongyang, right? He was working
in Pyongyang. Yeah.
They were outsourcing animation work to a North Korean company.
Weird experience. Yeah.
Okay, good news. Shenzhen, a travelogue from China by Guy Delisle. Delisle and Helga Dasher. And it is available.
And the one about Pyongyang, because I've been there, is the scenes in the Yanggado Hotel, the Yangjiaodao Hotel, with the turtles and the aquarium at the bottom, which you've been there, you'll recognize. And, I mean, it's very lifelike. You know, the way he draws is a very good, accurate depiction of the way things actually look like.
Yeah, he drew shit from a Shenzhen toilet. and the description of the shit is really hilarious. Yeah.
Because it's different from Quebecois shit? I'm looking at some of it from on Amazon right now, and the guy, he has some significant artistic talent. My recommendation, are we done here? Is a little short film called 特殊教育. I don't know if you've seen this. It's a 22-minute long. It means, you know, 特殊 means sort of a special, 交易 is exchange, a special kind of deal. And
sounds very dodgy.
It looks dodgy at first. I mean, the opening scene shows a woman who's clearly a prostitute with a pretty heavy Dongbei accent, apparently negotiating with a customer who's off camera and handing her more money and saying, you know, I don't go home with anyone for this amount. I would not do it for that amount of money. And a few more bills are added, and finally she goes, and then we see that it's a small child, a third grade boy who is asking her to come to his parent-teacher day at school and pretend to be his mother.
Mm.
And it is hilarious and utterly heartbreaking, and I challenge you to watch this without crying.
Fantastic.
And it is just so well shot, so well done. It's maudlin. It's very deliberately tear-jerking, but apparently my wife, who's very deeply into film, says that the editor and people they're all very, very well-known people, but it's all nobody actors. Very effective use of 22 minutes, and the child actor in it is just unbelievably good. Unbelievably good. So 22 minutes of your time. If you follow me on Facebook, I linked to it recently. Otherwise, I'll make sure to put it on our podcast page. So, Matienzia, thank you so much for coming in, and we will see you again soon. And I want to say hi to Matt Sheehan, and actually a bye to Matt Sheehan. He's been sitting here in the studio saying, say hello, Matt.
Hey, what's up, Seneca?
He is here. He's actually taken off to go back to the States, actually, in just a matter of days now, huh? But we will be hearing from you soon. I'm sorry. Oh, my God. I forgot to turn off my phone. Sorry.
All right. Take it home. All right. Take it home. Enough
waffling. Take it home. All right. And goodbye. And we'll see you next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care, folks. Bye.